Okay. Yeah, so to kind of go out to big picture before we kind of come in. So for one of the longest running kind of arguments in the Buddhist tradition is this question of is awakening, enlightenment is the word you're more familiar with, awakening is a better translation of the word Bodhi, is awakening sudden or gradual? Yeah, and this is, you know, it's a deep theme that plays throughout Buddhist history, and different major kind of schools of Buddhism having different attitudes to this question, which is obviously, it's kind of an important one, isn't it? Or is it kind of like, you know, 50 years of sitting in a monastery meditating for 6 hours a day? You know, like although it's a historical theme, the reason it's been a long-running theme is because it's relevant to our lives, to our approaches to the Dharma, our approaches to life, yeah? So is it sudden or is it gradual? Yeah, this is a question which, in some kind of way, we're going to explore over the course of today. Yeah, predominantly from an experiential sense. Don't worry, I'm not going to give you detailed analysis of like this school of Buddhism was in favour of that. If you find that interesting, then we can chat about that. But that's not the major focus. In a way, one of the reasons why this is a central question of the Buddhist tradition is because the Buddha consistently taught that actions have consequences. You know, conditionality, pratitya samapada, dependent arising, that everything happens independent upon a consequence. Yeah? But Buddhism has got this problem, but it then says that nirvana is without causes. So then you have this problem. So if everything happens for a reason, but nirvana's got no reasons, then how do you get from here to nirvana? You have this big problem. Sangharakshita, within the Buddhist tradition, there's an answer to that. There's a way around that, which has been historically underemphasized, which is unfortunate. It's a problem in Buddhist history. So the major focus of true vatana is what we call kind of like a positive spiral of conditionality. This positive state goes rise to that, gives rise to that, gives rise to that, gives rise to that, gives rise to that, and then from there awakening happens. That perspective has run through the Buddhist tradition, but for some reason people don't emphasize it, and you end up with this slightly problem-oriented approach to Buddhism where life is a problem and you need to stop it. Yeah, so you know, if you've read anything of the Buddha's teaching, you'll be familiar with him saying, stop it, basically, just whatever you're doing, stop it, with kindness, of course. So that's a bit of big picture. In a way, with a slightly dubious metaphor, but let's give it a little go anyway, Sangharakshita is suggesting that actually the spiritual life is much more like an evolutionary process. So as I understand it, based on fairly limited understanding, the theory of evolution does account for what's called sudden shift evolution. So you have this, you know, like survival of the fittest, and you know, like, oh, he's got slightly longer legs than me, so he runs a bit faster, so he doesn't get eaten by tigers. It's kind of this very gradual process of unfolding. But then within that, you have these sudden points, these sudden shifts, where something quite important and significant happens. Yeah. So, for example, it's, you know, like gaining the ability to fly. Yeah. So it's like if you imagine like creatures spend, you know, like thousands of generations slowly developing wings, which are actually a waste of time and get in the way. Like it doesn't quite make sense. At some point, you just have this quite sudden shift, and all of a sudden, things are flying. Or like the development of brains, you know, it takes ages to develop brains, so at some point you have a sudden shift, doesn't it? If you know more about that than me, you can tell me about it later, but I find that quite a compelling argument. And Sangharakshita was suggesting the same could be true for our spiritual life. So you have this gradual process of trying to be aware, trying to be kind, trying to be a bit more mindful, trying to be a bit more ethical. And then, intermittently, something quite, you know, like you can have quite a major shift in experience and understanding and perspective, and suddenly everything feels very different to how it was before. Yeah, so the Buddha is categorical that the experience of awakening is a sudden shift. Yeah, like, yeah, you were kind of plodding along and suddenly you're awakened and it definitely feels different. It's not just that, oh, I feel a bit happier today. It's that something really substantial has taken place, and that's important to keep hold of. Buddhism accounts for both, you know, this gradual process of awareness, of deepening awareness, and actually sometimes life can feel very different quite quickly. So what do we do about this? Yeah. There's multiple things you can do. So one of the things you can do is that you can say, stuff this gradual process thing, I'm just in it for the sudden shifts, because that sounds where the fun is. That is not a classic Buddhist approach. You know, like Sankaracharya would categorize that by the artist or the madman or something like that, you know, like the psychonaut who takes vast amounts of drugs to explore consciousness. Well, they're forcing a sudden shift, and his suggestion is that's uncomfortable and not very successful. Or you can just be incredibly gradual about it, which is kind of fine, you know, you'll get there in the end. But then the question arises, well, in some ways what would be ideal is to have a happy medium, so like really placing faith in the gradual process of unfolding, but also looking for, and in a certain sense, inviting sudden shifts. Inviting sudden shifts, because obviously that's, we all want to get somewhere quickly, don't we, although that's arguable, but yeah, like, kind of move us along. So to some extent we can invite them. Obviously that's the image like breaking through to Buddhahood, it is quite a violent image, you know, there's a certain degree of violence in that image. Like radical shift, kind of like letting go of old patterns, breaking out, breaking through, which can be uncomfortable. That's why you need to put the gradual stuff in place so that you can deal with the sudden shift. Yep. So gradual is good. Sudden shift is a useful add-on, but it's better to have gradual and no sudden shift than have sudden shift but no gradual. But given, of course, we've all got gradual going to a reasonable extent, let's talk about sudden shift. So in a way, the question is, what holds us back? Yeah, what is it? What are the... In some ways, well, the way Sankaracharya takes this is that what are the systemic aspects of our experience which inhibit quite a different experience of being alive? What holds us back? Yeah. And he's got... four key areas in which we can be held back, or kind of, and as I go through them, you'll see that they're quite, you know, they are really quite systemic. So we'll talk about them for a bit, then we'll meditate to explore them, and then we'll do something else to try and explore them a bit more in another way. We'll do that in a minute. So he suggests four very broad categories of experience which can hold us back. So the first one is like painful and negative emotional states. So in a way, what he's saying here is that it's really easy just to get into a habit of being a bit stressed, a bit depressed, a bit habitually kind of in a rubbish mood. And what he's saying is kind of just recognise that's a habit, and actually just say, okay, let's stop being like this, let's do something about this, let's transform our minds. Really raining, isn't it? So in some ways, the first one and the second one bleed together a bit, and this is kind of very big picture, and to a certain extent slightly simplistic, so if you're thinking, yeah, but it's not as easy as that, well, of course it's not, but he's just making a point. In a way, he's pointing out that it's easy to go through life thinking that our current mood is a given. And he's saying, actually, just question that. So, like, the obvious one in our culture is depression. For a lot of people, they just they get into a state of mind where they assume that depression is normal, is their normal experience, and they never quite take it on. And again, it's like, you know, depression's really hard. I'm not saying it's, you know, it is really hard. But in a way, he's holding a flag for a different way of relating to the world, a different way of seeing. And of course, and as we go through today, the Metta-bhavana is, in a certain sense, the Metta-bhavana is the royal road to awakening, yeah? So the Metta-bhavana is a direct way of addressing our preponderance to negative mental states, in a sense, no matter what they are. Bit grumpy, Metta-bhavana. Bit depressed, feeling sorry for yourself, Metta-bhavana. Bit isolated and emotionally dead, Metta-bhavana. You know, like the Metta-bhavana, the cultivation of loving kindness is, in a way, what's so interesting about it is that it is a psychological mental health adjustment tool, but it's much deeper than that. It goes much further than that. The purpose of the Metta-bhavana, the whole, just to digress for a second, so in a certain sense, the Metta-bhavana in five stages, as we do it with ourselves, a friend, a neutral person, that's not how the Buddha taught the Metta-bhavana. It's a later, very useful, very important modification of the practice. The way the Buddha originally taught the Metta-bhavana was much more challenging, in the sense that he said, just contact your experience and have an attitude of goodwill to every aspect of reality. So, you know, the fifth stage of the Metta-bhavana, where we're trying to relate to life with a sense of openness and curiosity and connection. The Buddha goes straight to that. Experience suggests that can be quite hard to do, which is why we put these preceding stages in. And they're very useful for helping people resolve their relationships with the world. But fundamentally, that's what the Buddha's getting at. And he's, you know, so it's the reason why that's a royal road to awakening is because it's directly counteracting this tendency to separation. Yeah, so this sort of like, in a sense, this root, you know, the root delusion that, you know, you and I are separate, that I am me in my own isolated little bubble inside. And everything else is out there, and therefore scary. Well, either therefore a source of craving, I want it, or a source of fear and aversion, I don't want it. That's the root delusion. The Metta-bhavana directly can, and does, directly undermine that by just having a sense of openness and connection, curiosity. It's like, oh, you're a valid human being. Wow! Yeah, so negative emotion. In some ways, there's negative emotion. It's one of those things which, you know, you can define it with increasing refinement of subtlety. It's like, oh, I'm not grumpy. I'm scratchy. I'm not scratchy. I'm spiky. Do you know what I mean? You could kind of define all of those. It's like, oh, no, grumpy and spiky are different mental states. But frankly, folks, possibly not worth the hassle. Sometimes it is, if it's, you know, like, it's kind of worth getting interested in the nature of your mental states. With the Buddha's kind of starts off with a much bigger picture. It's like, oh yeah, it's the experience, negative mental states, the experience of delusion, separation, isolation, that as an emotional state, and that driving is either into craving, grasping, or into aversion, fear. Those are the core, and everything else are just further definitions of that. May or may not be useful. So that's the first thing that holds us back. The second thing that holds us back is psychological conditioning. Yeah. So psychological conditioning, you can see how, well, psychological conditioning is often the breeding ground for our negative mental states. So there's obviously a direct link between them. And in a way, this is what this centrally is the stories we tell ourselves about what it's like to be us. Yeah. So I'm like this. I'm a shy person. I'm a happy, friendly person who everybody likes. Both of those are psychological conditioning which, based on experiences in our past, which limit us, which constrain our sense of experience and how we relate to the world. you know, basically, you know, like what it was like for us when we were kids and how that impacts on how we relate to the world today. So in some ways that's very interesting because it's, you know, like for, I would say opinions divided on the place, like the place of therapy, for example. Okay, so how do you resolve your psychological condition? Do you have to go back and remember it through the therapeutic process or what? The British tradition is very clear that we need to, well, we just need to be sensitive and we need to use appropriate tools. So clearly, you know, like as I'm sure you do, and I certainly know people who've had extremely, you know, grim experiences in their lives, and they definitely need professional help resolving those issues. Yeah, like, it's like, my God, you know, that's really, that's very, very painful conditioning, and you definitely need help in resolving that. And of course, the UK is not quite so bad for this as the States. And Sangrechta is definitely cautious about the kind of the therapy culture or the, or, you know, layering the story of therapy onto our experience. You know, the like, you know, you have these images, not so much now, but certainly a while ago, where in the States it's like, yeah, the only person people ever really talked about their feelings was with their therapist. And, you know, you saw your therapist every week. And that was your actual human relationship and everyone else wasn't. So he's cautious about that. He's cautious about embedding a story, in a way, because that's psychological conditioning in itself, isn't it? Oh, I need a therapist. The only person I can talk about my emotional experience with is my therapist. Well, that's the psychological conditioning which inhibits us. Yeah? You can see what I'm saying. So in some ways, the Buddhist tradition maps very well with, I'm not very familiar with it, these sorts of terminology, but what I think of as, like in a sense, like a more progressive wing of the therapeutic tradition, which is much more focused. It's not focused on understanding our past experience as changing our emotional relationship with it. So it's like, so it's not about going back into your past and like remembering what happened. It's like, it's about changing how you relate to your experience right now, and that places us directly in line with Dharma. The reason I think this is important is because, certainly in my own experience, in my own mind, many of, like, my sort of my core psychological conditioning is pre-verbal and kind of pre-conscious. Yeah, you know, like, it's all that stuff, you know, like, when we were babies, did our mums kind of cuddle us all the time, or were they a bit distant, you know, like, that sets the tenor for your whole experience of being alive. Basically, we can't. I don't believe it's possible to verbally resolve that if you were a baby which didn't get hugged enough when you were a kid, because it's totally pre-verbal. So it's just somehow it's got the work that needs to be done is deeper. You know, it's an acceptance of and an understanding our experience here and now, which then allows something new to happen. So again, you can see how the metta-bhavana, well, particularly the first stage of the metta-bhavana, is addressing that issue, kind of being at peace with ourselves. It's like, this is me. It's all right. Yeah, like, I'm not perfect, and I'm da 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 da. You know, like, I ask my partner, there's lots of ways in which I'm not perfect, but I'm okay, and I'm okay with myself. So that's one kind of side of psychological conditioning. The other side of psychological conditioning, which Sangrechta mentions as a way of looking at the kind of the ubiquity of the framework with which we interpret our experience, the sort of like the way which it in a way he's just inviting us to see the framework, for want of a better word. The other one he does is invites us to explore, or he just says, oh, what's it like being in different cultures? Yeah, so what's it like being, you know, travelling, being somewhere else? And the opportunity to realise that our, what we think is how the world works, is just our way of thinking how the world works. Yeah? And sometimes that can be, I don't know if you've had these moments, sometimes that can be quite, you can definitely experience a sudden shift. It's like, oh God, the world, I thought, I just assumed everybody was like this. And they're not actually. So my main experience of, my most substantial experience of foreign cultures is being in India. And India is right for opportunities, for just having these little moments where you're just like, oh, the world is... God, the world is just very, very different. People experience the world in very, very different ways to how I experience it. So probably the most distressing experiences I've had in my life centre around human beings in India who are in a certain sense living the lives of animals. Yeah? So I've experienced human beings in India, particularly distressing in the case of small children, who I would argue their consciousnesses are all they ever think about is food and safety. Yeah, they live, their lives are sufficiently precarious that all they ever think about is food and safety, because they never have enough of either of them. Yeah, and that is it's quite in a certain sense it is quite shocking. It kind of and of course this is again where the metta bhavana is important, because the tendency when you experience something like that is to just shut down and withdraw because it's unpleasant and overwhelming. So the metta bhavana, you kind of need the metta bhavana to stay open to the experience of looking at another human being, thinking, my God, all you ever think about is food, because you've never been full in your entire life, and you're like 7 years old, and you've never been satisfied in your entire life, not even on the basic level of having enough food in your belly. And really, really trying to see that is very, very, it's very, very challenging. I'm not at all convinced that I feel like I've done that to some extent, but I feel there's further that one could go with that. And, you know, and inevitably, one, at a certain point, one closes down because it becomes overwhelming. I would say the most distressing experiences of my life have been, just interacting with children in that respect. Some of you heard me tell this story before. Probably the most extreme one was walking, late at night, 10 or 11 o'clock at night, walking across a platform in a fairly small town Indian station with a small child with its arms wrapped around my legs, screaming at me as I dragged it across the platform because it wouldn't let go. That was not a proud moment. I'm not saying that's a good thing, but that was a moment when my capacity for metta had left me, But the child, what's interesting, the child wasn't treating me as a human being either. They were treating me as an ATM. They were like, give me something. And I'm like, I just couldn't bear it, frankly, and I just closed down. But yeah, that was, possibly one of the most unpleasant experiences in my life. Yep. that was good. Very vivid memory. But that experience of psychological condition, it can also, in some ways, this is where India is interesting, because it can also cut the other way, where you can have these amazing moments of kind of like of something else, something really amazing can come through, this moment when you feel deeply connected with a human being or whatever, something else comes through that. In a certain sense, I would argue that's, or the experience of preciousness, you can experience a real sense of preciousness. Yep, psychological conditioning, our the stories from our childhood and the experience, the sort of ubiquitous assumptions we make about how our culture is. And both of those are things which actually can have quite an interesting experience of seeing through. One of them is a more personal work and one of them is more external work. Yeah. Although, and again, this is like the overlaps, because one of the core things that people experience through going travelling, I would argue, is a recognition that they have substantially taken for granted just how fortunate their lives are. And it's like, oh my God, so fortunate. So fortunate. I'm insane. And that can turn into guilt, or that can turn into a very positive sense of appreciation. Yep, pushing on. So rational thought, yeah? So this is, in some ways, this is probably the most challenging of these things. The way to which we think that thinking is normal and the way that the world works. The Buddhist tradition is utterly clear that the Buddha does not deny rational thought, but he does assert that that rational thought is not the universal value, that there's states of mind which can be occupied which are outside of rational thought, and actually the truth, the experience of the truth is outside rational thought. You do not think your way to awakening, you experience your way to awakening. And thought is a necessary tool to get you there, but it is not enough on its own. So that one's a bit kind of like, how do you get a handle on that? What he suggests here is the realm of myth, of image, of symbol. Yeah. So there's other ways of getting into it, but that's one way. It's just letting letting our responses unfold, like being non-rational. So I find it very interesting that, having just said I'm going to push on, I've just read this short book essay about the need for myth in addressing climate change, which I found very, very interesting, very, very, very good, written by a guy who's been a major figure in climate change policy making on the level of the UN, like at the highest level of climate change policy making in the world. He now thinks that what we need is myth, because he's saying, look, pie charts don't fix it, folks. Pie charts are not going to motivate you. You need to have a deep myth about what it's like to be a human being and our place on this world. That's the only thing which is going to make actual change possible. So that simply would be an example of a sudden shift, a story about our world, about what it's like to be alive. And finally, the perception of time. Yeah? So the story of time. In some ways, these are all stories, aren't they? So he's suggesting, that thing about what time is it? Oh, what time is it? Oh, yeah. So he's saying, just have a go at not having time. Yeah, that's his suggestion in here. Have a go at not having time. Don't know if you've ever done that. It is really interesting. Even if you just do it for a morning. Yeah. So you just, Sunday morning, tomorrow. Have a go at not having time. Yeah, just turn your clocks around, turn your phone off. Just don't have time for morning. See what it's like. Yeah, and what he's suggesting is that there's kind of like what we call clock time and organic time. And organic time is time, because obviously we experience time, so it's the story of time, the construct of time. Because as we all know. Classically what happens when you're bored, time goes very, very slowly. And when you're having a good time, time flies. Yeah? So our experience of time is subjective. And if you let go of clocks, that allows us to more experience have a more genuine organic experience of time. Sometimes it can be really weird, can't it? I don't know if you ever have this, like you're kind of doing something. And it feels like you've been doing it for ages. Like meditation would be a classic example. And then you look at the clock and it's like, my God, only 5 minutes have gone past. What the hell's happened there? And then again, particularly with meditation, it can be very clear, can't it? And then we kind of settle a bit more and kind of get into the zone. And then all of a sudden it's the end of the meditation. You're like, where did that go? So letting ourselves have that more organic experience with time. Yep. So just to round up, so there's a few things. So the Buddhist tradition has got this kind of major, in a sense, soteriological. Soteriological is a word for the Christian tradition. What it means is what we're doing, yeah? So how we're getting there. Soteria, it's a word for Jesus, and it's a philosophical term. So the Buddhist tradition has got a major soteriological issue with the gradual and sudden, is it gradual or is it sudden? Triratna, and we would argue core Buddhism, says actually it's both, haha. You make gradual effort, and on dependence on that gradual effort, then sudden shifts occur, can occur. Sankaracharya would go further than that, and he would say that gradual effort is necessary, the metta bhavana is necessary to sort of prepare the ground so that the sudden shift can be assimilated. So I don't know if you're familiar with this. Aldous Huxley wrote an essay called Heaven and Hell back in 1930s probably, in it which he explores religious experience, madness, and hallucinogenic drugs. And he's basically saying the experience is the same, the mental states associated with it are the same. Don't think that's completely true, but there's some truth to it. And the difference is that religious experience is grounded upon a gradual work, which means that the intense experience can be dealt with. Yeah? And again, this isn't true for everyone, some people, but some people's madnesses are, they've really seen something, but they've just got no capacity to assimilate that experience, so therefore they just crack up. Yeah? Not everyone by any means, but some people. So we need gradual effort to allow the sudden shift to not be disruptive to our experience of being alive. The metta bhavana is the crucial way of achieving that. Because it's very broad, yeah? So it addresses, in a way, it addresses a lot of these things of what holds us back. Not all of them, but some of them. So what holds us back? Well, this experience of negative emotion. Well, the metta bhavana helps with that because it's directly cultivating love. The experience of psychological conditioning. The metta bhavana helps with that because it helps us resolve our relationships with ourselves and with other people. Rational thought. Well, the metta bhavana helps with that because it's a different story. It's a story of connection, a story of meaning, slightly bending that one in. And time sense, the metta bhavana is just good because meditation helps you experience time in an organic way, as do other meditations. Less embarrassing for Vasa. But in a way, the reason why the metta bhavana is crucial is because this image of the breakthrough, what we're talking about is here we are having a certain experience of consciousness of self. Say it's like this, yeah. And what the Buddhist tradition is saying that actually our experience, well, there's no limit to our experience of consciousness. So this needs to break. This needs to grow. This needs to unfold. And at a certain point, it needs to break, yeah. And if we've cultivated a sense of metta, then that breaking breaks into a kind experience of consciousness which can absorb and assimilate that experience. If you don't have enough metta, then the breaking is unpleasant and painful and disruptive. So the metta bhavana is key to making the breakthrough as pleasant as possible.